Okay, our next case this morning is number 17-1287, Bly v. Shulkin. Mr. Selinsky.
May it please the court, Brandon M. Selinsky on behalf of the claimant appellant, Mr. Bly. This case is about a veteran's application for EJF fees, specifically about the disparity in the veterans court rules governing the timing of when an EJF application, the filing time begins to run. Under the EJF statute, a successful party has 30 days in which to file from the final judgment, which to file an application. And so the question is, when is the judgment final? Under Rule 36, a judgment is effective date.
What do we care about Rule 36? I mean, the statute says final judgment means a judgment that's final and not appealable. And your argument is that it was appealable until 30 days ran, and that should be tacked on to the end of the period. Who cares what the trial court's rules say? They can't overcome the statute, can they?
Your Honor, it's not clear that the statute is referring to the kind of mandate order that was in this case. So
that's the question, is what's the meaning of the statute? They can't change the statute with the rule.
Agreed, Your Honor. And it's not our argument that it does, although...
haven't all courts interpreting final judgment in 2412, the EJF statute, interpreted final judgment to be final and non-appealable?
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
So, again, what difference does the Veterans Court rule on that make? What we have to determine is whether the judgment was final and non-appealable. And that usually means the time for appeal or further review has run, doesn't it?
Correct. So our position is that the time for appeal had not run. So even though it's a final order, there were still 60 days in which...
So the question, I guess, is, and the government, I think, cites maybe one case to suggest this, but it sounds like there's other cases, including from us, that suggest the otherwise. Can the time for appeal essentially be truncated upon agreement of the parties?
Your Honor, I think that it can, but I don't think that this case is clear that it does. So in the motion, both sides agreed that the case would be remanded. And the court agreed to that, but Mr. Bly did not agree that he would give up his right to appeal. And I know that seems like an odd result, because if we want this judgment, there's no reason why we'd want to appeal, but that's consistent with what a lot of other courts have held.
But if the consent judgment had included the additional line saying no appeal shall be filed, would the time then start to run from the date of that judgment or at the expiration of the appeal period after that judgment?
Your Honor, I think it's still at the expiration of the appeal, at that 60 days. And again, just to give an example of another...
So I don't understand your answer to my previous question then, which you seem to agree that the parties could alter the time for appeal in the consent judgment, but I gave you a hypothetical where they agreed to alter the time for the appeal by saying no appeal could be filed at all, and you said that still didn't do anything. I mean, you may be right that the statutory appeal period is a statutory appeal period, and the Veterans Court can't change that by rule, and the parties can't change that by agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a conflict in the circuits here, isn't there?
Yes, Your Honor.
As to what the rule should be.
Correct.
And in Preza, we seem to say that we wanted to apply a blanket uniform rule without making it depend on whether a particular judgment was appealable or not appealable, right?
Correct, Your Honor. That has the advantage of being consistent. A consistent rule to kind of bring all these conflicting decisions together so that a claimant can know what that rule is. The example I was going to give is in Social Security. No matter whether the government agrees to the remand, there's still a 60-day waiting period that you have to endure. But
what if the remand order says something to the effect that the parties have fully settled all claims, et cetera, were remanding for some administrative task?
Your Honor, I think that there's still a 60-day waiting period. And again, that's for the sake of consistency so that every claimant after that knows that there's still going to be a 60-day waiting period. Whereas here, there is one rule, and this is a rule, again, going back to the rules, Rule 41 abrogates that and says, well...
You're saying that in every case, you have 60 days that applies. You can't think of a single exception where the 60-day would not apply. It'd just be 30 days from the entry of the judgment of the court.
Correct, Your Honor. That's right. And that provide again, the consistency that provides...
I'm not sure the present supports quite that broad a proposition. If you look at 1371, this is 531, Fed 1371, it says the better procedure is to avoid preliminary litigation of time periods for each of filings when there's been a voluntary dismissal. The question is whether that would apply to a consent judgment, but assume it does. It says at least where the order of dismissal does not specifically prohibit appeal. So at least under Judge Hughes' hypothetical, Impreza might say, no, no, you don't get the benefit of the appeal period under those circumstances. No?
I think that's true, Your Honor. And what we're trying to argue here is that particularly in a case where you have an Article I court, where you have the Veterans Court, you have a veteran who is applying for EJF fees, that veteran ought to, as the Supreme Court has put it, get that thumb on the scale. So even though the rules seem to conflict with one another, in a case like this one, the veteran ought to get that additional benefit of the doubt.
I don't know if this is in the record or not, but what part of this litigation did you apply for EJF fees before? The proceedings before the Veterans Court leading up to the joint motion to remand?
Correct, Your Honor. That's right.
And the government agreed to the joint motion to remand?
They did. Okay. They drafted it, I think. In addition to the veteran getting that thumb on the scale, the government in this case is not prejudiced at all. In fact, they did not object to our EJF fees. The Veterans Court did, and that's why we had the oral arguments at the court below.
How much are we talking about?
Relatively little, Your Honor. It's in the range of about $3,000. And the reason that we have appealed it this far is we don't believe that's fair to the veteran, despite what that might cost us.
And you didn't appeal equitable tolling. That issue's not before us.
Correct. I don't believe that applies here. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Curlin? So why isn't Impreza governing here?
I think that's the question that's at the heart of plaintiff's appeal. How can a Veterans Court consent order be final and unappealable for EJF purposes if there's some possibility, however remote, that it could still be appealed? And the answer to that question, and it goes to Impreza as well, is that approach that appellant has taken here is both contrary to the EJF statute and bad for veterans.
I understand the argument, but we've got a precedent here in the Impreza case, and you're not contending, are you, there's a difference between a voluntary dismissal and a consent judgment?
We are, Your Honor, and there are two
purposes of appeal. Really?
There are two distinctions here between this case and the Impreza Garufi case. First of all, that was a unilateral voluntary dismissal motion. This is a joint consent order. The second distinction is that...
Well, why should that make a difference?
Because...
Yes, it's different, but it's not a relevant difference.
It makes a difference because, and this also goes to another distinction between this case and Garufi, it implicates the EJF statute itself. The EJF statute makes clear at 242412D2G, and as well as the legislative history, but it's pretty clear in the language of the statute itself, that...
Can I ask you this? I know I'm interrupting you, but in terms of interpreting 2412, the courts have generally held that final judgment means final and non-appealable, right? And non-appealable is usually means the time for appeal is exhausted.
Including an order of settlement. That's the language of the statute. And the legislative history goes on to explain that it's clear that EJF intends for the 30-day period to begin on the date of an order of settlement. Any settlement is appealable on the type of remote grounds that we're talking about here. If the rule is that the remote possibility of appeal makes this final, not final and unappealable for EJIA purposes, then the statute would be meaningless.
Well, wait. Why shouldn't we construe settlement in there as referring to what Judge Reyna was asking about before, which is a settlement of the entire case, the case is over with, as opposed to an agreement about a particular issue?
I appreciate the opportunity to clarify that, Your Honor. In the context of veterans court practice, that's precisely what we have here. This is what a settlement, and in fact, a vast majority of settlements look like in a veterans court case. It's not like, for example, Court of International Trade practice where there's a remand that goes back
and
forth.
The statute's a general statute. It's not directed to the veterans court. The question is what they meant in the statute by settlement. You can't say, oh, well, in the veterans court area, most settlements are just with respect to a particular issue when they wrote this statute broadly. And one might think that what they meant by settlement was a settlement of the entire case.
I understand, Your Honor, and that's precisely what we have here.
That's the thing. This isn't a settlement. It may be. I understand. I know the VA system, and this is what happens. The settlements aren't entered into at the veterans court that resolve the case very often, if ever. But that doesn't mean that we alter the definition of settlement. This is a consent judgment to vacate and remand for further board proceedings, and it's pretty typical of federal court's proceedings.
What is?
Let me ask you this. If after this consent order was entered, somebody filed an appeal, the veteran filed an appeal within the time for appeal that said, I agree to this under duress, would you argue that that appeal is untimely, or would you argue that they had waived the right to appeal?
Well, the veteran, as an initial matter, would have waived the right to appeal. In that circumstance, the appropriate thing to do, there's a remedy for that.
But that means that the judgment was still appealable within a certain time period. And so it didn't become final until that period for appeal expired, even though on its face it looked like the veteran had voluntarily agreed to the consent order.
Well, Your Honor, that same exact argument would apply to an order of to any order of settlement. And there's in any case of an order of settlement, someone could within a 60-day window appeal and say, "I didn't agree to this. This was under duress." And the EJIA statute is clear that
But see, this is the problem. This isn't a settlement. You want to describe it as akin to a settlement. It's a not. If you had a veterans court order saying the parties have agreed to settle this case, it is dismissed as of X date, then you might have a different order and we might have a different rule.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, in the veterans context, this is a settlement, and I'll try to explain why.
I know exactly what you're saying. That they never agree to settlements that pay out benefits at the Veterans Court because the secretary thinks that they don't do that, that it's the obligation of the board to award benefits, decide service connection issues, and the like. They may be right. That just means that the settlement process is not something that can happen at the Veterans Court. It doesn't mean we should alter our definition of settlement.
Well, it completely ends the litigation. That's the issue.
It doesn't end the litigation any more than a joint motion to remand from the CIT back to the Commerce Department ends the litigation. And I think you would agree that that kind of joint motion to remand would not become final until the appeal period to this court runs.
There's a big difference between this, and I think that's a key point, so I want to make sure I'm clear on this. There's a difference between this and that type of remand to the CIT. This is more akin to an appeal to this court, for example, there's a slight difference because it really does end the litigation. And the way this works is that because it's a federal court, the CIVC.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's say somebody files, an agreement to voluntarily remand from this court to the Veterans Court. Does the appeal period not apply at all? Is it final as at that date? Or can they still change their mind and decide that was under duress and file a cert petition to the Supreme Court?
Well, in that case,
within the 90 days,
right? Again, if it were like a voluntary dismissal, yes, they could still do that. If it's a settlement agreement where it's a joint motion and they're saying we've agreed to settle this case.
I mean, isn't the real problem here that you can resolve this issue practically by determining whether or not you're going to allow EJF fees to be petitions to be filed in these joint motions for remand? If you had to put in a sentence in this joint motion that said fees are to be borne by the parties for these proceedings, they would have waived their right to file EJF fees. And we wouldn't have to be worrying about this, right?
I think the parties could do that, but they're not.
Why don't they? I mean, the Veterans Court enters into hundreds, if not thousands, of these joint motions to remands every year. The parties enter into them before the Veterans Court. Why doesn't the Secretary have a practice of determining whether it's going to allow an EJF fee, a petition to be filed or not?
I can't speak to that decision making, but what I can say is that the Veterans Court's jurisprudence and rules are specifically set up in this pro-veteran way. Again, this completely ends litigation. Because it's a federal case and a board case, there's no more federal litigation. We understand that proceedings continue with the board, but it is done. It completely ends the proceeding. There is nothing else for the Court of Veterans Claims to do, and if it came back up to the Court of Federal Claims, it would be a different case.
Veterans Claims, but it doesn't end the case insofar as there's been a remand to the board, right?
But if it came back, it would be a completely different case with a completely different number. It's not the same case. There would be a new EJIA. There would be a new EJIA application.
It also doesn't truncate the time to appeal. You say it ends the case, but you also agree that they could file a timely notice of appeal. They may be barred because they've agreed not to appeal, although here it doesn't even seem they agreed not to appeal. It's just a motion to remand. You'd probably argue that it was voluntary, and we'd probably agree with you.
Well, that's
but it doesn't end the federal litigation in the sense that it's not final and non-appealable until the time for appeal runs.
That's where the common law comes in, which says that in this type of situation where parties have entered...
You're trying to make us distinguish between voluntary dismissals and consent judgments, and I think you're pointing to a Third Circuit case when there's a Ninth Circuit case that goes the other way.
Well, there's considerable authority on the Ninth Circuit case is a slightly separate issue, but on the authority there's authority throughout the circuits, including the Ninth Circuit, including this court's decision in Taylor Brands, where courts have consistently recognized that when a party consents to the substance of a judgment. And I mean, but consent here.
Taylor actually hurts you because what Taylor recognizes is that there's sometimes there are consent judgments that can be appealed because Taylor suggests you have to distinguish between an agreement as to the form and agreement as to the substance. And so you can have situations in which there is an appeal from a consent judgment. And what we said in Impreza is, we're not going to decide this on a case-by-case basis. We're going to say if there's a possibility of an appeal in some circumstances, put aside the situation where there's either an entire settlement or an agreement not to appeal, we're going to apply a blanket rule. And I guess I come back to the question of why would you distinguish between a voluntary dismissal for that purpose and a consent judgment? Putting aside your argument about the settlement language, let's assume you lose on that. Why would you distinguish between a consent judgment, which can be appealed sometimes, and a voluntary dismissal, which can be appealed sometimes?
Well, this is not an instance of a form versus substance distinction.
No, I understand.
Here, there was a consent on the substance.
What we said in Impreza is we're not going to do this on a case-by-case basis. We're going to have a blanket rule because it's simpler for everybody and people know where they stand. And they said we're going to have a blanket rule for voluntary dismissals. And the question is, why shouldn't we have the same blanket rule for consent judgments?
Well, in creating that blanket rule in Impreza, this court looked to the D.C. Circuit's decision in Adams. And what Adams spoke about, and it's a longer decision, so I have to summarize it here. It talks about, you know, there should be a uniform rule where you look at a category of rule and then the applicable law of appealability. So this is a separate category of rule. It's a consent order. It's not a unilateral dismissal. And the applicable law of appealability, as so long as there's a consent to the substance, which is certainly the case here, is that it's not it's not appealable, except in these really remote circumstances. And I mean, we've cited there are thousands of cases. We're not aware of any such circumstance. And those same circumstances would apply to any settlement, which EJIA is making clear, and even if one assumes there's a distinction between a settlement and a consent order. EJIA makes clear that a settlement, which is just...
I'm still a little confused about why it makes any difference and what the ramifications are going to be here. I mean, if we went with your rule that consent judgments are different, and somebody was... But you agree that in some circumstances, an appeal can be filed within the time period. If somebody has missed the 30-day time limit from the date of the judgment to file an EJIA application, wouldn't they just file a notice of appeal before the time for appeal expires, which would make it a non-final judgment, and then file their EJIA petition? It would still, because you agree that they can file an appeal within 60 days from this consent judgment. They're going to lose, but they can do it. And if they file it, it certainly renders it a non-final judgment of the Veterans Court.
I can't speak to what might happen at the Veterans Court in that scenario. But
that's exactly the kind of thing we were trying to foreclose in UNPRESA and establish a uniform rule. And what's wrong with a uniform rule that says, you know, in any kind of order from the Veterans Court, it doesn't become final until it's final and non-appealable, which includes the appeal period?
I see my time's running out, so there are two points I need to make sure I get in here. The first of all is that these rules are specifically set up to be pro-veteran. And so the approach that is being advocated here is certainly bad for veterans. You're talking about taking thousands of cases.
Is this about the mandate and that they have to wait to act?
Yes.
I don't understand that at all. There's nothing that prevents the board from acting on the Veterans Court mandate, even if the time for appeal hasn't been exhausted.
The Veterans Court
provide the mandate issues when the remand order is entered. So that frees up the board to continue to act on the case without waiting for the appeal period to run, doesn't it?
No, for two reasons. First of all, Cerullo versus Derwinski says that mandate in the Veterans Court context works much like mandate here, where the lower court cannot take jurisdiction back of the case while the case is pending at the Veterans Court.
But when you issue the mandate, it goes back. The mandate doesn't have to wait for the time for review to be exhausted, does it?
It does under the Veterans Court's decision in Westfall, where they said, we're wrong about the appeal period.
That's their decision. They don't have to follow that. We issue mandates all the time before the time for cert has been exhausted. We issue mandates after 45 days. But the time for cert doesn't exhaust for 90 days. People ask us to stay the mandate all the time. We refuse all the time. So the district courts have to act on our mandate before the time for review has been exhausted. I don't see why the board and the Veterans Court can't do the same thing. There's nothing that prevents the board from acting on the Veterans Court mandate, even if there's still a potential appeal to us. Is there? Nothing legally.
The court's decision in Westfall takes the view, and it seems to be a correct view, that if the appeal period is still running, it is not appropriate for us to issue the mandate. The court essentially gave a mea culpa and said, you know, we issued mandate, but because there has been no explicit waiver of appeal here, unlike in a consent situation,
we can't issue. Well, you want to say the Veterans Court is just like us, but then you're saying that they think they can't issue a mandate until the time for review is exhausted, and we certainly do. You understand we do this all the time. I know. You've practiced here a lot. There's nothing, and if we issue a mandate to the district court and they say we can't legally follow it until the time for cert is expired, that's legally wrong. A lot of them probably wait as a matter of course, but they're not legally forbid from complying with our mandate. And in fact, we could order them to expeditiously comply with our mandate if we wanted to, couldn't we?
I think Your Honor's, you're correct, obviously.
And the Veterans Court could do the same. It could order the secretary to start the board proceedings immediately, even if the appeal period hasn't expired, couldn't it?
To my knowledge, the Veterans Court, and I can't paraphrase all of Westfall here, but Your Honor can certainly look at the case. The court has taken the position that it is not permissible for it to do that.
Do you agree with that? What's the legal justification for that?
Well, in the Veterans Court, you don't have a situation of like a discretionary certiorari appeal situation. Here, you know, the mandate is supposed to be the end of the case. The court's rules at 41A say mandate is when the court's judgment has become final. It is in Veterans Court's practice, I mean, it occupies this weird position where it's a kind of intermediate appellate court. It does not have this discretionary cert process hanging over it where, you know, the practical way for parties to proceed is to follow the court's judgment, but there's this remote possibility that the Supreme Court could take the case. That's not present in Veterans Court practice. Their mandate is intended to be signaled not just that the judgment has been entered, but that the case is final. And at least if one reads Westfall, it's clear that the Veterans Court, you know, they said, look, this is going to hurt veterans, but we can't do it.
Now, again, you're relying on their mandate rule. If we interpret 2412 as saying final judgment, including consent judgment, means until the time for appeal is exhausted, the Veterans Court has no authority whatsoever to alter that through rules of court defining final judgment as something else, do they?
Agreed, Your Honor. This court, obviously, in Carbino-Hoods-West has recognized that the Veterans Court can promulgate rules, but they can't overturn this court's rules. One final point to make briefly is I just want to be clear for the record that our understanding is this is not a matter of money coming out of the veteran's hide. You know, ultimately, the veteran received benefits on a forward-going basis. The only time that EJIA fees end up
getting involved. Sure, we get that, but the whole point of EJIA is to encourage people to represent plaintiffs or other individuals in suits against the government that otherwise couldn't get attorneys. So whether or not it's ultimately going to come out of the veteran's pocket is really irrelevant. If we can't pay these people fees when they're entitled to file for them, then they won't represent them.
I understood, Your Honor. We just want to make sure the record was clear on that point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Perlman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Selensky.
Your Honor, my friend's arguments did not raise any additional issues for me, but I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court has.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Selensky. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.
Thank you.